Well, it is a pleasure to be here and to have this opportunity to minister to you. I have the dubious task of speaking to an audience after lunch, especially a delicious lunch like that. I decided that I was just going to nibble because I have to speak. And I think that at least one of us should be awake through this session. By the way, let me just preface my role and what I can bring to a conference like this. I'm not a musician. I don't really have a technical knowledge of written music. I can't read music. I certainly can't perform. And my interest isn't in the finer points and distinctions of aesthetics. There are plenty of people here who are qualified willing to engage in that study. I have always been more or less fascinated and concentrated on bad music, and really bad music. And I'm glad that Pastor Willequit brought up the anecdote of his visit to the Pentecostal church, which shows that rock music, which is what I will be addressing for the most part, and contemporary Christian music, rock music, has penetrated even praise and worship, which then means that at least something that I will have to say today will be applicable to this conference. So I'm going to describe, as you have in your outline, you can fill things in as we go along, define music. I think that's very important because the definition is up for grabs, not just good or bad music, but what really is music. And we'll work our way through that, and I hope not to insult your intelligence if some of this sounds rather simplistic, but these concepts are things that we have not come to agreement upon, so they need to be defined. What is music? Music is, first of all, sustained sound that is ordered in time and space. Now, sound is fairly obvious. Music cannot involve total silence or non-sound. By sustained, I mean that sound is connected and it flows. In some sense, some may define that as the that part as the melody. By ordered, I mean that there is a pattern to it, including variation, conscious organization that you can actually identify. By time, I simply mean that it has a beginning and an end that you can track on a clock if you choose to. And by space, I mean that music just doesn't happen in the mind. I think that's perhaps a little redundant with sound, that it happens in the material world. Notes on a page do not constitute music. A song in your head does not constitute music. It has to occur in space to be music. Secondly, music to be music must be the result of creative intelligence and not of randomness. The sound of rain on a tin roof is not music, and I would contend even wind chimes, even if they sound nice, are not music. As creative intelligence, it comes to us from personal beings with self-consciousness and not from animals. Animals can be said to sing, songbirds, for instance. And though there is an order to it and a pattern to it, it is not creative, but it is instinctive. Also, their singing has a practical goal of communicating something important to other birds, and so it's more like language, spoken languages. Now, animals can respond to music. Dogs, for instance, tend to howl when they hear music, but that is only, again, a response to man-made music. Thirdly, music is expression. It's an expression of this personal being with creative intelligence to another like being. And this means that communication is going forth and taking place, and ideas and images are being communicated. But this communication also has its limits. Music is not a language that can communicate on the level of words. It can't express something like, I'd like to have some of that chili, or the roast beef sandwich, please, in that sense. Music cannot do that. What music expresses are feelings, moods, emotions, and images. In other words, you cannot express the content of the Gettysburg Address on a harp, but you can express the solemnity of the occasion on a harp. Next, music must have an aesthetic feature to it. That is, it needs to have, it must be beautiful, or have elements of beauty in it. That is, it needs to appeal to something very deep within us that is mysterious and cannot adequately be described, only experienced. And the appreciation of music is limited to image bearers, that is, creatures who have been made in God's image. An intelligent animal, like a dog, cannot appreciate beauty, beauty of a sunset, or even its own beauty. The fact that we can appreciate beauty testifies, I believe, to the existence of God. Now think about it this way. Morse code, which some of the listeners here actually are engaged in using, is also sound ordered in time and space. It's an expression of creative intelligence. But it lacks one thing. It lacks beauty. It does not have an aesthetic element to it. It doesn't touch our artistic sensibilities. Now, we may define beauty in music differently, and there's a lot of controversy over that. But the point is that it evokes a sense of beauty, that music itself evokes a sense of beauty and artistic appreciation within us, if it is to be music. Now, anything that is called music that lacks one or more of these elements, I would contend, is not truly music. Painting is not music, obviously, because it doesn't have the property of sound. Though it does have order, expression, creative intelligence, and beauty. A lawnmower engine is not music, though it makes sound in time and space, and there is, in some sense, an order to it, even a rhythm to the engine, if you listen carefully. But it is not expressive, it is not creative, and it certainly is not beautiful. A bird can sing, producing sound ordered in time and space. It can express something that may sound beautiful to us, that we see as pleasing, but it is instinctive, not intelligent or creative, and therefore it is not music. Now that we've given a very broad definition of music, let's talk about how music communicates. Music communicates by way of audible symbols that stand for something else in the real world. And a symbol is something that stands for something else. Music, as symbol, represents feelings, moods, emotions, ideas, and images. And we as listeners make intuitive connections between the musical symbols that we hear and the emotions that they represent so that we actually define music as happy or sad or blue. And we don't realize that we're making those connections as we go along. Now, how does music represent sadness, for instance? Well, how do sad people move? They move slowly. They speak softly. The reactions are not jerky or abrupt, are they? Music can itself represent sadness by being slow and having soft tones. And the intervals between the tones are small. The number of instruments can even be few, such as a lone flute to stand for the aloneness that we feel when we're sad. How does music represent anger? Well, how do angry people tend to characteristically behave? They tend to act in haste, they are eruptive, and sometimes disorderly. They also tend to be rather loud and tense. There's a lot of tension and anger. Music can represent anger by being abrupt, sudden, authoritative. It can contain great volume that can escalate into an explosion. So then, music represents emotions by reproducing them in sound. Now, I think it's just as important within our conservative circles to talk about how music does not communicate. Music does not affect us directly like drugs or alcohol do. It cannot control your behavior. It cannot make you mad, sad, happy. Whether you like it or not, you do not fall helplessly under its control. Those who believe that music does act that way, the general term for this doctrine is known as the hypodermic view of music. That is, that music penetrates your body and your mind and your will, and causes you to fall helplessly underneath its spell. Now, many conservatives see rock music as acting this way, but they are mistaken. Now, there's a book out by several scholars in the Seventh-day Adventist camp that takes this approach, and I'm going to read some quotations from the Christian and rock music for you to show that the hypodermic view is still alive. The first one goes, another important reason why rock music cannot legitimately be Christianized is that its hypnotic beat can alter the mind, weaken moral sensitivity and inhibitions, and cause people to write, see, and do the most hideous things. Continuing, they say rock music can hypnotize people because it makes its impact musically rather than lyrically. As sociologist Simon Frith points out, a word-based approach is not helpful at getting at the meaning of rock. The words, if they are noticed at all, are absorbed after the music has made its mark, unquote. Now, this book is quoting another author, Simon Frith, but the problem is they are misquoting him. When Simon Frith says that the music has made its mark, he doesn't mean that after the music has taken control of your body. He simply means after the music has sent its message, which can certainly be in the way of symbol and referent, as I described earlier. This is in fact what Simon Frith believes. He does not believe in the hypodermic view. In fact, he opposes it, and yet he has been misquoted here. Let me continue. The subordination of the melodic line in rock music to a pulsating, relentless rhythm has an hypnotic effect that causes people to lose touch with reality. Bob Larson states, the steady pounding can cause the mind to go into a state of daydreaming in which it loses touch with reality. This, in turn, causes the the dancer or listener to lose touch with the value system related to reality. Any monotonous, lengthy, rhythmic sound induces various stages of trances. It is quite obvious to any qualified, objective observer that teenagers dancing to rock often enter hypnotic trances. When control of the mind is weakened or lost, evil influences can take possession. And one more. There is no way to insulate the body, the bodily responses from the pulsating and pounding power of rock music, because it impacts directly on the body, bypassing the mind. Now, if they were correct, then the Bible narrative would be incorrect. I think you have a text before you, 1 Samuel 18, 10 through 11, that is in conflict with the hypodermic view. Now, it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved inside his house while David was playing music with his hand as times before. And there was a spear in Saul's hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." Now, as you can see here, David's playing was not able to soothe or relieve Saul's torment. It looks like Saul was able to block or resist the power of the music, and contrary to the mood that David wanted to convey, he tried to kill David in cold blood. And we see the same kind of thing happening in our lives also, don't we? Many circumstances, we are forced to hear undesirable music, say at restaurants or at work, and it doesn't force us to act improperly. Music, then, doesn't control us, but it does influence our behavior. It suggests rather than forces, but sometimes it can suggest rather forcefully. And that's, in those instances, a lot of people take that to be, consider that to be hypodermic, that it actually compels us when it just suggests forcefully. Now, the ability of music to convey meaning and influence behavior as simply a symbol system, the one that I advocate, is evident in the success of the Muzak service. You're aware of Muzak, that they go by other different names now, but they manipulate the behavior of shoppers, waiting room patients, and factory workers through different types of music. The power of music, even as symbol and referent, is demonstrated by one of the most vigorous opponents of the hypodermic view, and that is rock historian and rock scholar Robert Walser. Let me read his quote for you. "At the end of an Iron Maiden concert I attended in 1988, light, happy, Muzak-style music came through the house PA system to accompany the crowd's exit. I didn't recognize the tune, but it was very close to It's a Small World. This vapid music, so incongruous after Iron Maiden's powerful show, was clearly intended to disperse the energy of the concert, promoting orderly exit and calm reintegration within with the world outside. It succeeded remarkably. 15,000 screaming, sweating, straining heavy metal fans were transformed into a group as sedate as any homeward-bound symphony orchestra fans." Okay, this is from someone who rejects the hypodermic view. Now, I want to stress that a rejection of the hypodermic model is not a denial that music, especially electronic music, can affect living organisms, including people, in positive and negative ways. Musicologists give evidence that music can, in certain instances, penetrate human beings directly in biological rather than strictly psychological ways. Now, this is, again, not affecting behavior. It is just somehow affecting the body. One heavy metal fan admits if it's really loud, and he's referring to heavy metal, it kind of affects your heartbeat and stuff. Jeffrey Arnett, a scholar on this, states that on occasion, at a metal concert, you can actually feel your ribcage vibrating. Robert Snow observes, quote, that in the 1960s, sound technology enabled groups to crank up the volume so that you could actually feel the music pulsate throughout your body. This wasn't a latent function. It was by design. James Lull. Nearly every person in the United States at some point hears a pop music concert live and comes into thrilling contact with sounds so loud and compelling that it seemingly takes over the body. And finally, Stephen Davies, musicologist, who is a strong opponent of the hypodermic view, still concedes that, quote, music might trigger some responses simply by being heard. For example, it might affect in a predictable manner the heartbeat or rate of respiration. It might trigger muscular twitches. But again, this is not a behavioral compulsion. Now, moving on, the hypodermic view all by itself is pretty flimsy and problematic. But some have made it even more reckless by applying this doctrine to the phenomenon of demon possession and demon possession rituals. I think every one of us is familiar with missionary anecdotes from the 1970s that went something like this. You've got a missionary family that goes off, say, to the South Pacific, and they begin to minister among the people there, and they begin to play their Christian music tapes. They do it long enough, and all of a sudden they get a knock on the door. And it's one of their converts, a rather new convert, who's all in a panic, and he says, "Why are you playing the devil's music?" And the Christians insist, "This is not the devil's music. This is our Christian music. This is godly music." He says, No. I'm the one who, I used to be a witch doctor before I was converted, and I actually used this beat to summon demons. So what happens then is that the family becomes convinced that the music that they're playing is demonic and ceases to play it. Fast forward, they send it to the United. They send this information. It eventually gets to the United States, and then it begins to circulate within conservative circles, and it reaches almost the status of a doctrine. Now, those who were supporters of contemporary Christian music decided to do some investigating of this type of thing, because they were suspicious. And they discovered that the offending tape, at least in one of those instances, was not rock music after all, but upbeat versions of "When the Roll Is Called Up Yonder" and "He's Everything to Me." Not great music anyway, but certainly not rock music, and difficult to claim as demonic music. Furthermore, research on possession music shows that there is no uniformity in beat, instrument, and style of music that is used. Not all use drums. Some even use fiddles. Some have used rattles and tambourines and even flutes. So there is enough variation to demonstrate that the kind of music itself does not cause demon possession. Now, I don't... usually I wouldn't bring this up, but I was motivated because I'm finding that this kind of thing is still circulating within conservative Christian circles. I was asked to review and to write a FLAP recommendation for a new book that's coming out on CCM. And as I was looking through the table of contents with brief chapter descriptions, I noticed both an advocation of the hypodermic view of music and this idea of demon possession being related to it. And I was rather disappointed. I did write the author back, and I said, and I gave them, I basically told them what I've been telling you, and they said that they would reconsider. But the point is that it's still rather popular, and it needs to be addressed, because it all comes from this idea that music traps us and takes us away. Now, it doesn't mean I think music is amoral. I certainly think it is very capable of moral perversion. Having discussed errors on the conservative side, I want to look at one on the more liberal side, and that is a perversion of music as symbol. Even though that's the view I advocate, that also can be taken too far, and this is what I refer to as the associative view of music. Under this system, it's not just the notes, but an entire song or genre can take on a certain meaning based on the context of its performance. Harold Best, taught at Wheaton College, supports and advocates this view. I'll quote him. Music has no interior beacon that guarantees permanent meaning. Unlike truth, which is transcultural, absolute and unchangeable, music can shift in meaning from place to place and time to time. He uses the example of the tune, just the tune for the hymn, Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken, which had a long history of secular service prior to that in anthems and in concerts. And so, to Best, that indicates that it doesn't have any inherently sacred meaning. When the tune was attached to the German national anthem, Germany overall, it awakened negative feelings among Jews who could only think of the Holocaust when they thought of that song or that tune. Best also uses an example of a young man involved in a satanic cult that used, of all things, Bach's music for its liturgies. The man later became a Christian and was terrified whenever he heard Bach in the churches that he attended. Now, Best concludes, I'm quoting him, that there is no other way to explain this phenomenon other than that music, as music, is completely relative. Now, there is, of course, another explanation. The actual music, divorced from the situation, could be described, the songs that he's talking about, as reverent, melodious, majestic, serious, orderly, perhaps even joyous, depending on what your list, how it's performed. What has changed is the larger context with which the music is associated. Strong reactions have occurred not to the musical language, but to a negative setting that the musical piece as a whole has triggered. But this is not support for the neutrality of music. In the same way, if a happy song was playing in the waiting room when the doctor or surgeon approached you and told you that your father did not survive the bypass operation, that song that you had been listening to that's in the background while he's saying that, for a long time, perhaps forever, is going to be a source of great sorrow to you. But does that mean that the tune or the lyrics of that song are sorrowful or sad? No. The song has become so by accidental association and circumstance alone, not by any sad properties in the music or even in the lyrics. And most importantly, this example reveals that that this kind of the shift of meaning can also take place with lyrics, which Harold Best says are clear carriers of propositional truth. The associative model only suggests that true signification and communication can, in a fallen universe, be distorted or reversed by unfortunate circumstances or perverse applications like that of the satanic cult using box music. Listen to Stephen Davies again, who comments on the associative model and how it distorts our understanding of how music means. If now I am delighted by the slow movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 because I happen to be listening to it, when in the past I received news of my lottery win, then my delight is not to be counted as a response to the music as such. Put another way, the variety of responses labeled by Keevy as, quote, they are playing our song, unquote, is to be dismissed, since responses of this type result from private associations that such music calls to mind, rather than from attention to features of the music. Okay, so this is Harold Best's mistake. Therefore, we ought to realize that the associative model is not the manner in which music ordinarily communicates. Extraordinary circumstances and unusual reactions to music should not serve as models for normal musical meaning or musical neutrality. Now, since form is neutral in the understanding of contemporary Christian music and doctrine is unimportant, and I don't think I'm exaggerating that, what really we ought to be concerned with is the spirit or inward disposition of the individual who produces the music or the singer. So then, good intentions are what really count and please God, not style or genre. The attitude is pervasive, and I hear this all the time in my interaction with people who do not share my position on music. Let's look at some quotes. They're rather lengthy, but I think they're worth reading. Secular sociologists J. Howard and John Streck state, quote, the conclusions drawn are framed in individualistic terms that ignore completely the social structures of the industry. The attitude is pervasive in Christian music. In the same issue, contemporary Christian music publisher and original editor John W. Style wonders whether God is pleased with the industry. He then proceeds to sidestep the question by reducing the industry to its constituent individuals, concluding that individuals' attitudes are more important than their activities and that, quote, our hearts mean more to God than our habits, unquote. It is difficult to critique an industry and the structures it has developed if only the attitudes of the individual's hearts, something further argued to be beyond the measure of humankind, are deemed important. The approach ignores the possibility that anti-Christian practices have been embedded in the into the structures of the industry. Thus, hard questions go unasked as well as unanswered. Howard and Streck are not non-Christian sociologists who have vetted out the CCM industry right around the year 2000. Now, Gary Weaver, who teaches philosophy at the University of Delaware, gives a more Christian perspective. Weaver says, I'm quite willing to grant the good intentions, but to insist that good intentions are enough seems too close to one or another ancient and modern heresy. Saying that it is my own private thoughts and intentions that determine the character of my Christian life at least flirts with Gnostic thinking and other special non-Catholic revelations. It also risks a Manichaean rejection of the corporeal world as a proper realm of divine salvific activity, and perhaps even a dichotomizing of the blatantly corporeal narrative of the Old Testament from a supposedly more spiritual and thus private New Testament gospel of salvation. He continues. Yet this inward and personal understanding of Christianity is characteristic of much contemporary Protestantism, both evangelical and mainline. Methodist theologian Stanley Hauerwas has observed that post-Enlightenment Protestantism is unusual in Christian history for assuming that being a Christian reduces to questions of one's state of mind, whether those questions be matters of confessional doctrine or evangelical decisions to accept Christ as my personal Savior. Lutheran theologian David, continuing his quote, Lutheran theologian David Yeago more generally refers to this tendency as the disembodiment of Christianity and observes how starkly it contrasts with the dense corporeality of earlier forms of Christianity. In the earlier, more corporeal Christianity, creation is not sanctified by good intentions and pious thoughts, cheerleading for Jesus, an acquaintance of mine calls it, but by the public presence of a bodily people drawing created things into new patterns of usage within a distinctive corporate way of life. He closes, Weaver, by saying, denying the corporeality of the faith makes it much easier to adopt the debased corporeality of the fallen. Unquote. Now, I realize that that's a lot of material, and it really deserves to be read more than once to understand and to grasp what these men are saying. But what these writers are observing within contemporary Christian music and evangelicalism in general is that evangelicals today have been taught to think about these matters with their glands rather than with their heads. It's basically what they're saying. This approaches the Mormon assurance doctrine of the burning in the bosom. If it, you know, feels right to my spirit. I don't want to minimize experience in the Christian life. We all have felt the conviction of the Holy Spirit. We can say that we have felt the love of God. But if we conclude from that, that the only thing that matters in worship and music is sincerity, then we forget that we are totally depraved, meaning that we can sincerely approve of something that God does not approve of. And those who endorse this misconception fall into the trap of thinking that the conscience is somehow sanctified and infallible. But Scripture teaches that even the Christian conscience is corrupted by sin. That's what 1 Corinthians 8 is all about. The person that's described in 1 Corinthians 8, 7 has a problem with a weak conscience. It reads, however, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol. And their conscience being weak is defiled. Four more times, this individual's conscience is referred to as weak. And you find that in verses 9, 10, 11, and 12. The specific weakness is that this conscience is over-scrupulous, that it could not detach an amoral object, meat, from its association with idols. From this, we ought to conclude that the conscience of a Christian can misjudge. It can be corrupted and defiled. In other words, it can suffer from the effects of depravity. Now, further, if a correct heart attitude sanctifies one's musical offering, does an improper heart attitude desecrate it? These are questions we need to ask. If so, how would we know either? As you know, that during some of the most productive years of her career, Sandy Patty was living in adultery. But only those in her hometown really knew what was going on. The people who attended her concert didn't. They resonated apparently with her spirit that she was
pleasing to God. How do you know? I mean, performers are supposed, you know, they have talking points. They have a certain manner of presentation that is really unrevealing and untransparent. How are you supposed to know whether someone is attitude is really godly? So really, that is very extremely subjective, and not the way that we want to approach musical evaluation, to be sure. Now, what I just discussed about the Spirit presupposes the following doctrine about the neutrality of music. And I'll quote, loosely quote, several different writers here. There is no such thing as good or bad music. All judgments on music are based on individual taste and preference. The individual decides what is good and bad. Now, this position implicates the advocate of this position, contemporary Christian music, with what is known as the Pelagian heresy. Pelagianism, you're all pastors, I'm sure you're, or most of you are familiar, but is a heresy that denies that man is tainted by sin at birth. Pelagius was a British monk of the early 5th century who had a very high view of human nature and free will. To Pelagius, man is not born with the congenital defect of sin, so that every one of his inclinations from birth are to sin. Pelagius even admitted that it was possible for man potentially to never sin from birth. He didn't think it was realistic, but potentially he believed it was possible. They didn't have to sin. Now, CCM's doctrine of aesthetics is Pelagian because its outworking leads to the conclusion that man's affections, at least when it comes to beauty, have not been corrupted by sin. In this sense, they go even farther than Pelagius, in that Pelagius at least believed that man could sin. But CCM feels that in the area of music appreciation, he cannot possibly be criticized or corrected. Listen to the Christian Rocker's Creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all music was created equal, that no instrument or style of music is in itself evil, that the diversity of musical expression which flows forth from man is but one evidence of the boundless creativity of our Heavenly Father. What they are saying is that there is no such thing as a musical bottom feeder, which is rank Pelagianism. Now, this assumption is false to the Bible because it violates the doctrine of depravity as taught in the Scriptures. When Adam and Eve fell, their entire person was polluted with sin. And we, as their grandchildren, many times removed, carry that same pollution within us at birth. The classical text for total depravity are Genesis 6:5, and the Lord saw that great was man's evil upon the earth, and every imagination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil all the day. And Ephesians 4:18 and 19, since we're coming out, see that again. I'll move on. Now, this depravity extends to every part of our human being. It extends to the body, as we see in Romans 6:6, knowing that our old man was crucified with him so that the body of sin might be rendered powerless so that we may no longer serve sin. Romans 6:12. Let not sin reign in your mortal bodies to obey its lusts. It affects the mind. Romans 1:21. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. 2 Corinthians 3:14 and 15. But their minds were hardened, for until this day, at the reading of the Old Covenant, the same veil remains unlifted, because it is removed in Christ. But to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their hearts. And Ephesians 4:17 through 18, perhaps the most powerful. This therefore I say and testify in the Lord that you no longer walk as also the Gentiles walk in the futility of their minds, being darkened in their mind, alienated from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their hearts. Skip the next text. The will, of course, Romans 6:17. And 2 Timothy 2, 25 and 26. But most importantly for our topic, the emotions and affections. Romans 1, 26 and 27. On this account, God delivered them over to dishonorable passions. For the females exchanged the natural use for what, for that which is contrary to nature. Likewise, also their males left the natural use of the female and burned in their desire toward one another. That is a perversion of the affections, homosexuality. Galatians 5:24, and let those who belong to Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and lusts. Again, affections. And finally, 2 Timothy 3, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, and here's the key, haters of that of good. Again, that is a perversion of the affections. And what this means is that depravity has penetrated our sense of taste and beauty, aesthetics. Our aesthetic impulse is made up of our emotions, our affections, and our intellect. And as you can see, all of them have been contaminated with sin, as we just read from the scriptures. Now, this doesn't simply refer to incidental imperfection, which is going to be manifest in any kind of human endeavor, but to sinfully distorted tastes and concepts of what is good, pleasing, and beautiful. Therefore, I contend that it is impossible to be orthodox as a Christian and teach that artwork, art forms, and art appreciation cannot be inferior, cheap, and grossly perverted. Therefore, the claim that there is no such thing as good or bad music and all judgments on music are based on individuals' taste is patently false to the Bible. And I've been asked by people if you were in transition with somebody who believed in this doctrine, you only had a few minutes with them, with someone who advocated CCM, what would you say to them? And I've said, I would first of all ask them, do you think it is possible for anyone to be a musical bottom feeder, to have perverted taste in music? And if they said no, then I would try to educate them on the fact that they have adopted a Pelagian position, a heretical position on human depravity. And because if the foundations, if we cannot deal with these foundations, then we cannot move on. Because until the CCM position on aesthetics changes, that is that what I've just described, it will be impossible for us to have meaningful dialogue about the appropriateness of rock or any other genre, for that matter. We are not able even to talk about whether rock is right or wrong until the CCM advocate agrees that it just might be wrong, that it's possible. Now, according to my worldview, it is possible that rock, jazz, blues, or any other type of music can be aesthetically good or even beneficial to Christian culture. You and I can sit down and you can tell me why rock is good, and I can either agree with you or I can argue the opposite. But within CCM's worldview, it is not possible that rock or any genre can be aesthetically bad. CCM's worldview will not even permit the discussion. To put it another way, my view says, don't trust your feelings, tastes, and affections without question, because all of them have been poisoned by sin and can mislead you. They don't always mislead you, but they can, and you have to be aware of that. You have to be humble. CCM says, when it comes to music, trust your feelings, tastes, and affections without question, because they can never mislead you. That's the upshot of what they're saying. They're saying, trust yourself, whatever turns you on. Don't let anybody tell you that your style of music is wrong. You see then why we must share the same worldview before we can even begin to discuss this whole question of the appropriateness of rock and other genres. CCM's worldview of aesthetics is Pelagian. It is heresy, and it must be dealt with. You must start there in any debate. And the flaw of Pelagianism is not solitary or isolated or non-essential to CCM's doctrine of aesthetics. That's why I think it's foundational. The flaw is systemic. The whole house of cards comes tumbling down. Because the moment they abandon their Pelagian position, they risk rejecting certain genres, and they will never permit that possibility. Now, there are some who recognize depravity in music, some CCM advocates, like Charlie Peacock, and he tends to be more theologically competent than others. He's a Presbyterian. And they will affirm depravity in other ways related to form, while denying that taste can actually be perverted. And you have to be very careful, because it sounds like they agree with you, but they don't. They say that music can be sinfully used, mismatched to the occasion, or more often, aesthetically, poor in relation to its own genre. But don't buy this, because all these things that I just mentioned, misuse, mismatched, and to be poor in relation to its own genre means that it belongs to another genre. All these problems are noetic perversions. They are not perversions of the affections. And that's what we're trying to say. That's what we're focusing on. They have diverted it by giving you noetic perversions, perversions of the mind, miscalculations, rather than of the affections. They still deny that musical forms and tastes can be perverted. In the remaining time, which is about 7 or 8 minutes, I want to cover some texts, just so you don't think that I'm pulling definitions out of thin air when earlier I gave you definitions of music, etc. Ordinarily, I advise people to tread lightly when using specific biblical texts related to music to support their particular doctrine of music. You have to be very careful here, because scriptural references to music seldom yield a high level of certainty and precision, and most texts have only a limited value in the CCM debate. When they do contribute, they do so most often indirectly. And having said that, I think there are a couple of passages, anyway, that offer indirect, though compelling, conclusions that help us understand some of the essential components of music. In 1 Corinthians 14, 6 through 11, the Apostle Paul borrows from the discipline of music to illustrate the futility of speaking in tongues without an interpreter. Now, I'll ask you to read this text on your own because of time, and we'll just keep moving on. Although Paul is only interested in the regulation of spiritual gifts here, his use of musical instruments reveals the planks of his musicology, his very simple musicology. Paul's doctrine assumes that music has the ability to communicate meaning. It also reveals what he considered to be the boundaries of music and non-music. In verse 7, he says, "Yet when lifeless objects emit a sound, whether flute or harp, unless they produce a distinction in the tones, how will what is being played on the flute or on the harp be known?" Now, Paul is claiming that without variation in tones, the message of the musical instrument is incomprehensible because it is meaningless. Paul would have been unable to draw such conclusions unless music, when played with a distinction of tones, that is, a meaningful melody, was capable of comprehension. The process is none other than the process of communication between the musician and the listener. Leon Morris, in his commentary, says, "Neither flute nor harp makes sense unless there is a meaningful variation in the sounds produced. A melody finely played speaks to a man's very soul. An aimless jangle means nothing." Two other scholars, Robertson and Plummer, say, "The music must be different." And this is, again, in relation to this text. "The music must be different if it is to guide people to be joyous or sorrowful or devout. Soulless instruments can be made to speak a language, but not if all the notes are alike," unquote. What Paul is his comparison with music of music with language indicates that he thought music was a language in its own right, capable of conveying ideas or feelings, emotions, and ideas. But more importantly, Paul reveals that for music to be music in the first place, it must have meaning. Paul is stressing that without organization and variation, the message of a musical instrument is meaningless. Now, Paul is thinking here of repetitions of notes without any variations. Just on and on and on and on and on. And that's not rhythm, but as a melody. Like a dripping faucet the sound of an orchestra while it's warming up and tuning, where each one is just tuning his instruments and you're entering before the concert, and that the sound that you hear, okay, that's meaningless. That's the kind of thing that he is referring to. Because what a dripping faucet and an orchestra warming up have in common is incomprehensibility. The distinction in the tones that Paul makes reference to points to the artistic sensitivity of human beings made in God's image, who can take these lifeless instruments, he calls them lifeless instruments, and have them articulate the mysterious and meaningful language of the emotions known as music. So then, meaning is an indispensable property of music as it is of language. And without it, it is not music at all. There's another implication that we can see here, and that is music that is itself cacophonous, chaotic, or conveys absurdity also would be considered by Paul to be either non-music or anti-music. That is, to the degree that music approaches Paul's concept of non-music and noise, to the same degree it would be criticized, we would assume. It's not that random sounds or even noise are evil in themselves, but when they are regarded as musical, they capsize one of the non-negotiable ingredients of music, and that is meaning. Another text, Exodus 32, supports this conclusion in 1 Corinthians 14. Because we can learn much about what the ancients regarded as the parameters of music and non-music. And this time I will read the text. "And Joshua heard the sound of the people when they shouted and said to Moses, 'There is a sound of war in the camp.' But Moses replied, 'This is not the sound of the forceful shouts of the victor, nor is it the sound of the cowering response of the defeated. It is instead the sound of singing that I hear.'" Unquote. Now, here is the scene. Joshua and Moses are standing on Mount Sinai. They're coming down. Moses has the tablets in his hands. They hear some sound coming from the camp. Thus far, they agree. Then, what Joshua's version of it is that it's the sound of a battle, war. Moses says, "No, it's not war, it's actually singing." Okay? Now, the record shows that Moses was correct. Moses, already knowing that the people had fashioned a calf for worship, was in a better position to identify the sound than was Joshua. And remember, Moses had been on a mountain and had heard a battle. at Rephidim in several chapters earlier. He knew what a battle sounded like. Joshua didn't. Joshua was in the battle. Now, it appears that Joshua mistook the singing around the calf as the sound of victory shouts and shouts of defeat, as you can just imagine, crying and shouting and yelling in a battle. But really, Joshua's assessment was not all that far from the truth to begin with. The singing was easily mistaken for battle noise because it involved excessive volume, aggressive vocals, and sounds of animal grunts and high-pitched screams. It must have sounded like a riot. Whatever the musical element, it was scarcely detectable to Joshua. So his reaction was based on sound traits that were alien to music, but native to the pandemonium of war. You could even say it was warlike singing. But that it wasn't singing as it ought to have been is indicated by Joshua's initial impression and Moses' sarcastic response. You know what Moses said, but really this is the gist of it. He said, "Believe it or not, this is singing." So this indicates that the sound mixture that Joshua heard was largely outside the boundaries of musical form. It was a violation of Joshua's definition of music because it was aesthetically impoverished and carried none of the thoughtfulness and conscious arrangement of music. What we encounter then in this passage is music on the verge of becoming non-music. The three essentials of music, sound, meaning, and beauty, are not entirely absent, to be sure, but they are pushed to their polar extremes. The sound element moves toward hypersound, meaning toward chaos, and aesthetic toward emetic. Although the noise of this passage would not qualify as an example of Pauline non-music, it illustrates that music that itself distorts its essential components approaches non-music and thus can be upbraided as bad music or anti-music. We could sum up the argument as follows. 1 Corinthians 14, Exodus 32 suggests that meaning, sound, and beauty are non-negotiable components of music, and that when any of these elements is missing or contradicted, music ceases to be music. When all the elements are present, but are of such poor quality that they approach self-obliteration, then such music can be considered anti-music, or at the very least, bad music. And so consequently, there is a warrant for musical criticism if the deforming properties occur on either end of the continuing. I've gone over time here, so I will stop and turn the service back over.